Imagine walking through a prison yard surrounded by murderers, rapists, and violent criminals, men who look just like you. This was Vince Everett Ellison's reality as a correctional officer at Kirkland Correctional Institution in South Carolina. What shocked him wasn't just the brutality he witnessed, but a disturbing pattern. Most inmates came from fatherless homes, lacked education, and lived in poverty. These criminals weren't born. They were manufactured by a system Ellison would come to recognize as deliberately destructive. 25 Lies has become a controversial yet influential text among conservative circles, with figures like Sean Hannity and David Limbaugh championing its unflinching critique of Democratic policies toward Black Americans. Born to sharecropper parents on a Tennessee cotton plantation, Ellison's journey from poverty to political candidate gives him a unique perspective on the intersection of race, politics, and power in America. His provocative thesis that the Democratic Party has systematically undermined Black communities while pretending to be their savior has sparked fierce debate about the true legacy of progressive policies in minority communities. Nothing prepared me for supervising 170 criminals at Kirkland Correctional Institution in South Carolina. These men, mostly my age, race, and gender, had committed heinous crimes while I walked free. What separated us? Through careful observation and countless conversations, three common factors emerged from my prison social laboratory. They came from fatherless homes, had no high school diploma, and lived in generational poverty. The consistency of these patterns across hundreds of cases was impossible to ignore, suggesting deep systemic issues rather than individual choices alone. Despite significant civil rights progress, Black Americans had lost ground in critical areas since the 1960s. South Carolina's prison expansion tells a stark story. From just three prisons in 1980 to 30 by 2000, a tenfold increase in two decades. Problems that barely existed in 1963 became epidemic afterward. AIDS devastated Black communities, mass incarceration separated families, and family breakdown accelerated at unprecedented rates. Statistical evidence painted a grim picture of Black men becoming an endangered species, with homicide by other Black men emerging as their leading cause of death between ages 15 and 34. Working in prison developed my ability to recognize evil in real time. My physical survival literally depended on it. I learned to read subtle body language, anticipate violence before it erupted, and identify manipulation tactics. The most devastating realization was seeing these same patterns of destruction in respected clergy, civil rights leaders, and politicians I'd once admired. These weren't just flawed individuals making mistakes. They represented collateral damage in what appeared to be a systematic effort to control the Black vote through dependency and social dysfunction. The historical parallels are striking and impossible to unsee once recognized. While Democrats once used physical tools like whips and shackles during slavery, today they employ more sophisticated mechanisms: systemic poverty, drug proliferation, mass incarceration, failing educational systems, and moral corruption. Their legislative agenda consistently undermines traditional values and family structures in Black communities, from welfare policies that incentivize fatherlessness to education policies that trap children in failing schools. Consider this pattern. Virtually every major urban ghetto, open-air drug market, deteriorating housing project, chronically failing school, and abortion clinic in America exists under long-term Democratic political control. These aren't random accidents or unfortunate byproducts. They're features of a system designed to create and maintain dependency. The pattern becomes unmistakable when you examine the outcomes rather than the rhetoric, following decades of policies that claim to help but consistently produce devastating results. For many Black Americans, this creates a psychological prison more powerful than physical bars, a mentality of helplessness and victimhood that passes from generation to generation. like Quasimodo in Disney's Hunchback of Notre Dame being taught by Judge Frollo to hate himself and believe in his own unworthiness, generations of Black Americans have been conditioned to view themselves through a lens of perpetual victimhood rather than personal agency and potential. This mental conditioning, reinforced through media, education, and political messaging, often proves more difficult to escape than any physical confinement. One of the most dangerous lies in modern politics is that voting decisions exist in a moral vacuum, that supporting policies can be separated from their ethical consequences. This thinking creates a slaughterhouse principle, where people believe being one step removed from evil actions provides immunity from responsibility. Just as a consumer who buys meat cannot fully distance themselves from the treatment of animals, voters cannot disconnect themselves from the impacts of their political choices. Consider the tragic story of Emmett Till. While the white perpetrators bear primary guilt for his murder, what about the Black man who identified him? Being under duress doesn't completely absolve moral responsibility. The man's choice, though made under extreme pressure, had devastating consequences. Similarly, voters cannot escape accountability for supporting policies that violate fundamental moral principles, regardless of their intentions. Whether it's supporting policies that perpetuate systemic inequality, environmental destruction, or economic injustice, the moral weight of these decisions cannot be dismissed. The American system makes this especially true. We are not subjects with leaders, but sovereigns with servants. Our votes directly empower representatives to act on our behalf, making us responsible for the consequences of their actions. When politicians implement policies that harm communities, whether through discriminatory housing practices, underfunded schools, or aggressive policing, those who voted for them share in that responsibility. This responsibility extends beyond Election Day to include our ongoing engagement with the political process. Democrats often deflect criticism by misusing scripture, quoting "Judge not," while ignoring passages about moral discernment and justice. They recite holy texts not to correct hypocrisy as intended, but to defend their own wrongdoing. This selective interpretation creates a false moral equivalence that prevents meaningful ethical evaluation. The same pattern appears in how some cite Martin Luther King Jr.'s messages of unity while ignoring his calls for radical systemic change. The reality is that God's moral law supersedes human political affiliations. Just as Eve couldn't escape accountability despite Satan's false promise that you will not surely die, voters cannot escape responsibility for supporting policies that violate higher principles. The consequences, broken families, failed schools, crime-ridden neighborhoods, environmental degradation, and widening inequality are the bitter fruit of these choices. Each policy decision, each vote cast carries moral weight that extends far beyond the ballot box. This doesn't mean we should condemn individuals, but rather evaluate actions and their consequences with clear eyes and moral courage. We should love everyone, show kindness, and offer correction with grace, but never pretend that political choices exist outside moral frameworks. True political wisdom requires acknowledging that every vote, every policy position, and every political alliance has moral implications that demand careful ethical consideration. The stark disconnect between pro-integration rhetoric and segregated reality in America's cities reveals a complex web of political manipulation. While Democrats publicly champion integration, their strongholds feature some of the nation's most segregated communities, from congressional districts carefully drawn along racial lines to economically isolated urban centers and chronically underperforming inner-city schools. This paradox demands closer examination. The historical record shows that Democrats established America's legal framework for racial segregation, and though those explicit laws are gone, they've adapted their approach to maintain de facto segregation through what I term the Iron Triangle, an alliance of Black religious leaders, politicians, and community organizers. This system creates the appearance of Black political representation while actually preventing meaningful integration and economic mobility. The mechanics of this system became starkly visible in 1989's Project Ratfuck, a revealing collaboration between the Republican National Committee and the Congressional Black Caucus. This arrangement redrew district lines to create more majority black constituencies, effectively concentrating African American voting power into isolated pockets. While this helped Republicans gain broader control of the House, it guaranteed Democrats perpetual control of these segregated districts. Over three decades, these areas have seen the promotion of destructive cultural influences, while black liberation theology has undermined traditional religious institutions that historically served as bulwarks against social decay. The modern democratic power structure in urban areas operates much like traditional slumlords, profiting from concentrated poverty while publicly lamenting its existence. This system has evolved over 220 years, systematically eroding community bonds and creating a culture of mutual distrust that increases dependence on democratic political machinery. Through control of education, housing policy, and social services, they've created a self-perpetuating cycle of isolation and dependence. It's crucial to distinguish between organic community formation and engineered segregation. The issue isn't black Americans choosing to live in predominantly black neighborhoods. It's the systematic use of political, economic, and social barriers to isolate communities from opportunity and advancement. True segregation in this context should be understood as a system where single-party control is maintained through deliberate separation of populations from their natural support systems, coupled with the systematic corruption of cultural institutions and traditional values. This framework explains the consistent pattern of democratic policies that undermine traditional family structures, religious institutions, and pathways to economic independence in black communities. Programs that appear ineffective at reducing poverty or promoting integration aren't failing, they're succeeding at their actual purpose of maintaining political control through manufactured dependency and social division. The destruction of black-owned businesses, the erosion of marriage rates, and the weakening of community institutions aren't unintended consequences, but rather essential features of this political strategy. The only love permitted by democratic leadership is that of a master for his slave, conditional, controlling, and ultimately self-serving. Since its founding, the party has sought power by subjugating, impoverishing, enslaving, and terrorizing those under their control while claiming to act out of compassion. Their political history rests on promoting division while claiming unity, destruction while promising construction. Like the prison captain in Cool Hand Luke claiming to break prisoners for their own good, Democrats claim to help the very groups they oppress, blacks, Hispanics, single mothers, inner-city children, and others. C.S. Lewis observed that tyranny exercised for the good of its victim may be the most oppressive kind, as those who torment others for their supposed benefit will never stop, believing in the righteousness of their cause. This perfectly describes the democratic approach to minority communities, claiming to help while implementing policies that perpetuate dependency. Consider how Democrats monetize poverty, spending up to $100,000 per person to maintain dependency while distributing only minimal direct aid. Their platform consistently promotes government control over individual liberty, family autonomy, and community self-determination. Democrat-controlled cities like Detroit, Milwaukee, and San Francisco demonstrate the results, crime-ridden and failing by design, with politicians gaining promotion through creating dysfunction rather than solving problems. This pattern resembles Orwell's Animal Farm, where Napoleon and the pigs exploit the loyal, hard-working animals while serving their own interests. Black Americans in democratic strongholds often resemble Boxer the horse, loyal supporters who work tirelessly for the collective good, only to be betrayed when they're no longer useful. The evidence is clear in outcomes rather than intentions. After decades of democratic control, inner cities have deteriorated rather than improved. Family structures have weakened, educational achievement has declined, and economic opportunities have diminished. If the goal were truly to help these communities thrive, different approaches would have been tried long ago. The LGBTQ movement, as championed by Democrats, isn't fundamentally about equality, but about undermining Christianity and traditional family structures. This agenda serves to weaken the institutions that have historically provided stability and meaning in Black communities. The movement's rhetoric of inclusion masks a more radical aim to restructure society's core institutions, particularly faith communities and nuclear families that have served as bedrock support systems. America's declining birth rate has shown a dramatic drop from 2.0 to 0.73 since 2019, correlating directly with aggressive promotion of ideologies that separate sexuality from reproduction and family formation. This demographic collapse represents what many scholars term societal death, yet it's celebrated by progressive politicians as progress and freedom. The implications extend beyond mere statistics, affecting economic stability, social security systems, and community cohesion across generations. The Equality Act and similar legislation function as what I call Daniel Test laws, regulations that force Christians to choose between violating their faith or facing punishment, just as Daniel was forced to choose between praying to God or being thrown into the lion's den. These laws systematically undermine religious freedom protections while claiming to promote equality. Small business owners, religious schools, and faith-based adoption agencies increasingly face legal challenges that threaten their existence if they maintain traditional religious beliefs. Even gay conservative commentator Brad Palumbo has criticized the Equality Act for undermining religious freedom protections, noting its overreach beyond basic anti-discrimination measures. Despite significant legal victories for LGBTQ rights, including Obergefell v. Hodges legalizing same-sex marriage nationwide, activists continue pursuing legal action against religious institutions, revealing that the goal isn't equality, but enforced conformity to new social norms. The Democratic Party's approach resembles a death cult that celebrates declining birth rates, family breakdown, and religious suppression while claiming to promote human flourishing. This agenda particularly harms Black communities where the church and family have traditionally provided strength, stability, and meaning amid external challenges. Historical data shows that Black churches and strong family units were crucial in helping communities survive segregation and economic hardship, yet current policies actively undermine these support systems. Government intervention cannot solve the baby bust because only a return to God-centered families can reverse the trend. The solution isn't more government programs, but a revival of faith, family, and community, precisely what democratic policies consistently undermine. Examples abound of communities that maintain higher birth rates and stronger social cohesion through religious participation and traditional family structures, demonstrating viable alternatives to current social trends. This ideological battle extends beyond policy debates to fundamental questions about human nature, social organization, and the role of faith in public life. The stakes involve not just religious liberty, but the very survival of institutions that have historically provided meaning, support, and stability to millions of Americans, particularly in minority communities. Like child molesters, psychotics are attracted to abortion clinics and Democratic Party leadership positions. Their stance evolved from safe, legal, and rare to safe, legal, and free, all while profiting from what amounts to infanticide. Democrats recruit the nation's most terrible citizens with leadership positions filled based on immorality rather than character. This pattern becomes evident in their shifting rhetoric and policy positions over decades. Abortion serves three primary purposes: bloodlust, money, and power, not women's health care or reproductive rights. Life begins at conception, supported by both scientific evidence and biblical teaching. Modern embryology confirms that a unique human life starts at fertilization, with distinct DNA and autonomous development. The my body, my choice argument fundamentally fails because it's illegal to use one's body to harm others, which is precisely what abortion does. This principle applies consistently across other areas of law. Democrats demand government funding for abortion while adamantly rejecting oversight or regulation, despite their own long-standing principle that accepting government money means accepting government control. This glaring inconsistency reveals their true priorities, expanding abortion access rather than protecting women's health. They fight against basic health standards for clinics while demanding increased funding. Research shows devastating consequences following abortion's legalization in 1973. Women's quality of life decreased dramatically, with comprehensive studies showing 30% increased risk of anxiety, depression, and suicide post-abortion. Black women particularly suffered. By 2015, only 34% married, compared to 64% in the 1960s, marking a dramatic decline in family stability. Meanwhile, Planned Parenthood generates substantial profits from selling fetal tissue while receiving $530 million in taxpayer funding annually, operating as a business rather than a healthcare provider. This system forces productive citizens to subsidize destructive consequences through tax funding, while responsible men accept paternal obligations without government assistance. The resulting crony socialism props up failed social actions, creating false positives that convince society harmful behaviors are virtuous. This perpetuates a cycle of dependency and social decay. The abortion industry specifically targets black communities, with Planned Parenthood strategically placing clinics in minority neighborhoods. Statistical analysis shows black women account for a disproportionate percentage of abortions, nearly triple their population percentage. Margaret Sanger's eugenic vision continues through different means, with black babies aborted at significantly higher rates than other demographics. In major cities like New York, more black babies are aborted than born alive. This isn't reproductive justice, it's demographic destruction masquerading as freedom, supported by targeted marketing and reduced access to alternative resources. The financial structure of the abortion industry reveals its true nature. Clinics often prioritize quick procedures over comprehensive care, with many operating on volume-based business models. Women seeking alternatives frequently receive minimal counseling about options like adoption or support services. This profit-driven approach contradicts claims about prioritizing women's health and choice. Parental freedom and education appears self-evident, yet powerful interests consistently oppose it. The Democrat-controlled teachers' unions demonstrated their priorities starkly during COVID in 2020, keeping public schools shuttered while private schools successfully operated without significant health incidents. This period exposed a devastating reality. Parents struggled with unprecedented challenges, including job losses, mental health crises, substance abuse, and even suicidal thoughts, while teachers continued receiving full salaries and benefits despite providing minimal remote instruction. The resistance to school choice reveals a deeply troubling dynamic in American education. Even parents who might ultimately select public schools deserve the fundamental right to make that choice freely. The argument against educational freedom often masks itself in concerns about equity and standards, but examination reveals a more concerning agenda of centralized control. When opponents claim choice is destructive, they're effectively arguing that parental autonomy itself threatens their preferred system. The parallel to historical examples of child sacrifice is particularly striking in urban communities. African-American families face especially limited options, with their children disproportionately trapped in failing schools. The statistics are sobering. In many major cities, less than 30% of students in predominantly minority schools achieve grade-level proficiency in core subjects. Meanwhile, the bureaucratic apparatus continues expanding, with administrative costs growing faster than classroom spending. School choice represents an existential threat to established power structures because it would fundamentally alter how educational content and values are transmitted to the next generation. The current monopolistic system enables a small group of decision makers to determine curriculum, teaching methods, and cultural messaging. When parents have genuine choices, many naturally gravitate towards schools that emphasize academic rigor, traditional values, and historical accuracy rather than ideological programming. The mechanics of implementing school choice are straightforward but revolutionary. Education funding would follow students through vehicles like vouchers or education savings accounts, allowing parents to direct resources to schools, public, private, charter, or religious, that align with their values and their children's needs. This market-based approach would drive innovation, improve educational outcomes through competition, and restore the natural authority of parents in directing their children's development. The resistance to such common-sense reforms exposes the underlying power dynamic. Educational bureaucracies, teachers' unions, and their political allies recognize that their influence depends on maintaining captive student populations. Every family that exercises choice diminishes their control over curriculum, staffing, and ultimately the philosophical framework through which young Americans understand their world and their history. Since George Floyd's death, Democrats claim racism is America's greatest problem. This narrative serves their interests while obscuring deeper issues. The real problems plaguing Black communities include the breakdown of family structures, educational failure, economic dependency, and cultural dysfunction, all exacerbated by Democratic policies. Virginia declared racism a public health crisis, effectively admitting the Democratic Party itself is the crisis given their century-long control of the state. Black Democratic leaders wrongly attribute freedom to government documents rather than God, causing psychological harm. When Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax carries manumission papers, he reinforces the flawed thinking that freedom comes from government rather than being inherent. Democrats illogically claim the government is racist while proposing to expand that same government to fix racism. This contradiction reveals the true agenda, growing government power rather than solving problems. Their policies consistently undermine the foundations of success, strong families, quality education, economic opportunity, and personal responsibility. The victim narrative promoted by figures like Angela Davis reinforces the idea that racism makes Black success impossible, creating a self-fulfilling prophecy of failure. This mindset keeps people dependent on government rather than developing their own capabilities and resources. The solution to these challenges isn't more government programs, but a return to fundamental principles. Become trained in needed skills. Race becomes irrelevant when you provide value, practice your religion fully, and arm yourself with knowledge and self-defense. Dignity comes from God and self-development, not from government programs or others' approval. This approach is illustrated by comparing Martin Luther King Jr. asking for dignity from a hotel owner versus Native American Chief Joseph Brant, who refused to kneel before King George III, stating, "I bow to no man, for I am considered a prince among my own people." The difference in mindset is profound. One seeks external validation, while the other recognizes inherent worth. The path forward requires rejecting both racism and victimhood while embracing personal responsibility, family strength, educational excellence, and economic self-determination. These principles work regardless of race or circumstances, but they threaten the dependency that sustains democratic power.